The Blues Brothers was well received and not well received when it came out, when the low budget film came out 44 years ago. Depends on who the critic was, or more importantly, how old the critic was. Daniel Devissay points out in his new book that the film, like Saturday Night Live and everything John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd did, came at a time when a generation raised on TV was ready to turn on or make fun of or do TV in a different, irreverent, improvised way. And the movie reminds us of that. Studio executives passed on the script left and right. The film finally found one wary suitor and went on to make millions and make history. The story of that movie, of the band, of Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi, of the Blues Brothers, is aptly told in The Blues Brothers by Daniel Devissay. Daniel, welcome to WGN Radio. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's an honor. Thank you.
What a great story. What a sad story, too. How did you come into this? What made you decide to pick this topic and write about this all these years later?
Well, it's my childhood. I'm from Chicago. I was just hearing you guys talk about an afternoon ball game. You know, that was me in Chicago in 1979. I'm from there. I love the city. I miss the city. And so I got to talking to John Landis, the director, about 4 years ago when I was working on a B.B. King biography. And I wanted to know why B.B. King wasn't in the Blues Brothers. And Landis, who's a great storyteller, started telling me stories about the making of the Blues Brothers. And I guess I was hooked. And so right then I knew that was going to be my next book.
And I guess there would be a number of ways to write about Belushi. I mean, you could have just done a sort of biography of SNL, or you could have done a John Belushi biography per se. This is very much that. But you really are telling us the story of that movie and that band, aren't you?
Well, I found it compelling that there is this generation of comedians who came up through Second City, which you Chicagoans know well, and National Lampoon and Saturday Night Live, the first iteration of it in the late 70s. And that covers, you know, Steve Martin, Chevy Chase, Bill Murray, Gilda Radner, Jane Curtin, Lorraine Newman, and our heroes. And I thought all of that would be of interest to people who want to know about more about the Blues Brothers. I mean, big fans of the Blues Brothers, at least in the United States, are people who, a lot of them are weaned on Saturday Night Live. And I just had a feeling people would want to know the background. And these guys had parallel paths through Second City and through SNL. So I thought it would be a compelling dual biography about this kind of great friendship.
Tell me a little bit about Dan Aykroyd. What's his story?
Well, so they're kind of opposites attract, I would argue. You know, one of them is tall and thin, one of them is shorter and stockier. That's the easy thing. Aykroyd is very meticulous, I think very detail-oriented. I think he's got all the method, and he was the guy who wrote these long backstories for the characters. Belushi is Mr. Effett, I mean, by his own account. This was a guy who would try to cross the border into Canada without a driver license. He went to the White House without a driver's license. He was a maniac, and he was brimming with energy. So typically, once they came up with these goofy characters, Aykroyd was the one who wrote them, but Belushi was the one who energized them and drove them. And I love the contrast between them, but let's not overstate that, because I think they also had a ton in common. I mean, both of these guys came up through improv, through Second City. Both of them wound up in the first cast of SNL. They had an enormous amount of shared heritage, which I think is why they fascinated each other and became best friends.
They became the Blues Brothers. What are some other characters or skits that we would remember that they collaborated on?
You know, they didn't collaborate on a huge number of sketches. They were dear, dear friends. They wrote together. They shared this horrible office space in Saturday Night Live together. So they did some stuff like sort of Henry Kissinger, Khrushchev-type bits. But really, the thing by far that they're both most remembered for together is these two characters. And if you saw those first seasons of SNL, you'll agree with me, right? Aykroyd's remembered for the Bass-O-Matic, yeah, and his great President Carter and his great Richard Nixon and stuff like that. And the Festrunk brothers, the Steve Martin, but Belushi for the samurai, right? And for stuff like that. But the thing that they really clicked on together as a duo on that show was the Blues Brothers, these characters.
Which people didn't know how to take. I mean, when they tried to sell that to Lorne Michaels, talk to us a little bit about that. Did they imagine that as comedy or music or both? How tough was it for, because these guys didn't grow up as musicians per se, so what the heck are they doing here?
No, what the heck are they doing here is exactly what I thought when I first saw them doing this act on SNL. I think I saw it maybe when the night it aired. All of us were wondering, well, what are these guys doing? Because they weren't professional musicians, not by a long shot. And I think this is unprecedented, where you have two big TV stars, TV comedians, suddenly decide they're going to kind of shuck that, or at least put that on the shelf, and roll out this band and go tour the country and release a record, which then went to number one. And, you know, all of us were kind of like befuddled, like, is this serious? Is it a joke? And all that really mattered in the end was people bought it. I mean, the record went number one, the Blues Brothers record that preceded the movie, right? And they were, as a very, very popular, successful sketch on SNL. And then we know what happened when the movie came out. So I guess it didn't matter in the end whether it was serious or not.
But Belushi really was playing it straight, if you will. I mean, he would do cartwheels and their dance moves were kind of manic, but that was Belushi. That was just the way, that was the only way he could do that.
Well, Aykroyd had been a blues hound going back to his teen years in Ottawa. He would go and see Muddy Waters, and he went to see Sam and Dave at the World's Fair in Montreal. Belushi was converted both by Aykroyd's influence and also when he was making Animal House, playing Bluto, out on the West Coast. He ran into Robert Cray, and you guys are going to know that name. It became a hugely famous blues guitarist. And Robert Cray's frontman named Curtis Salgado sort of initiated John Belushi into the tradition of rhythm and blues. So when Belushi came back from shooting Animal House, he was smitten. And that was when he and Aykroyd, with, again, with Belushi's enormous energy, launched into these two characters.
Was it Salgado who kind of patted Belushi on the chest when he was mimicking other singers? And he kind of patted him on the chest and he said, you know, it has to come from here. The music has to be your music, right?
Belushi had a brilliant Joe Cocker, which he had developed in Second City, even before Second City. He performed near UIC, near Circle Campus, and worked up this great Joe Cocker. And it got him part, it was partly why he got a job on Second City in Chicago way back when. But he kept doing the Joe Cocker. And Salgado was like, no, no, man, you got to be yourself. Stop imitating Joe Cocker. And he did. He did stop.
But Lorne Michaels was a tough sell, right? I mean, weren't they pestering him to do the act on the show, and Michaels just couldn't see it?
He couldn't see it. He didn't get why they were so into these two characters. I think they were pestering him week after week. And finally what happened was Lorne was a few minutes short, as often happened. They would have way too many sketches for each show. And then they would cut a bunch, and then he'd pray, Lorne would pray it was the right length. But this particular week, I think it was in April 78, it's now a famous, famous show with Steve Martin and King Tut. But it was a few minutes short, and so Lorne said, all right, if you guys want to make fools of yourself, go right ahead. And little did Lorne or the boys imagine that it was going to wind up being a, you know, a 2.5 hours feature film a year later. I mean, that would have been an insane idea at the time.
But the audience erupted when they finished their act. The audience was like, wait, what's happening here? Are they going to be funny? Should we be listening to this? But then somehow it worked, and when they were done, everybody knew that was something, right?
You know, Belushi, when Belushi went all out, you couldn't resist it. I mean, whether it's the samurai character, whether it's anything he did, even when he was in the bee costume, he's irresistible. I mean, he's a force of nature. He was a gravitational field when he was on Second City stage, you know, in Old Town. They couldn't resist it. And so when he came out with this compelling, passionate rhythm and blues act, he and Aykroyd were dead serious, but the audience loved it. I mean, basically, I think Mitch Glazer, the writer, put it well. Whatever Belushi was into, he could get the whole nation into, and that's what happened.
You've mentioned the bees a couple times, and Belushi famously hated that bit, but it was kind of a staple in the first season. In fact, he and Aykroyd, didn't they do the Blues Brothers in a bees costume?
That's right. So when Belushi and Aykroyd started on SNL, they were both frustrated musicians. They'd both been in bands in high school. Belushi was in a band that did like Rolling Stones songs out in Wheaton. But they were frustrated. They hadn't been able to really carry it forward into any kind of money-making thing. So they both wanted this, to perform. And they started doing a sort of sloppy rhythm and blues act with the band, the Saturday Night Live band, as a warm-up when the crowd was coming in. And yeah, so in January of 1976, in the first season of Saturday Night Live, they're allowed to go on live in the Goofy Bee costumes, because Lorne loved to torture and torment Belushi with the bees. And they did I'm a King Bee, and it was really for laughs. But that's kind of like a teaser of Blues Brothers, like 2 or 3 years earlier. For people who had watched every episode, they would have remembered those two characters.
How much fun was it researching this and watching the first few seasons of SNL?
Not only did I watch those, I watched every single episode of Second City Television. Not because I had to, because I wanted to. I got to interview Joe Flaherty, who was in that Chicago Second City cast way back in the day. I got to interview Tim Kazurinsky, who I think still lives in Chicagoland, another great talent. I got to interview all sorts of people who performed along with Belushi and Aykroyd in Second City, Saturday Night Live writers and performers, a bunch of Lampoon geniuses. I mean, boy, they're all, needless to say, very funny people.
Flaherty just passed away, as you know, and we mentioned that the other day. Talk about the culture at Saturday Night Live, the way those shows were put together, and the amount of drugs that were just everywhere, Daniel.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of college dorm-esque, I think. They were nocturnal. They worked very, very long hours, you know, because the show airs, Saturday night. So, like, starting around Wednesday, they'd get really crazy, and they'd be pulling all-nighters. They had cots in Belushi's and Aykroyd's writing room. And it was just the kind of schedule that I think only a bunch of 20-somethings at the time could have probably maintained. And weed was everywhere. Lorne evidently, I interviewed people who told me this, he would pass a joint around his office. You know, hey, I'm doing this, so I guess you guys can too. And it was kind of legendary that the elevator always smelled like weed when it emerged from that whatever floor they were on. And they were into harder stuff, especially later in my book. I talk about after the first season, as the performers got more jaded and there started to be some, you know, antipathy and some rivalry. Belushi was getting to be huge. Some of the other stars less so. So there was some anger and some rivalry, and there was an enormous amount of cocaine that came to be present in those offices. And nobody, of course, indulged anywhere near as much as Belushi. He lived life to the full every time.
Yeah, he really was kind of a Bluto character. You mentioned some of the rivalries, too. Chevy Chase was a big part of that. Even Gilda Radner, who wanted to do an album on her own and have her own gig, Belushi was against that. So there was a lot of fighting for attention and fame, wasn't there?
At the beginning, Belushi had a huge rivalry with Chevy Chase, and I think this was mostly one directional. Like, in other words, Belushi was angry at Chevy. Chevy wasn't probably even much aware of Belushi. Chevy, if you remember back then, was the huge star. He was the one whose name got said over and over again on the show, and he was kind of an alter ego to Lorne. They really adored each other. So Chevy was the big star. Belushi couldn't stand it. Earlier, Chevy Chase had a rivalry with Christopher Guest, if you remember that name from Lampoon, from National Lampoon. So, and Belushi fed off these rivalries. But then after Chevy departed, it became Belushi's show, sort of. But then Gilda Radner also became really big. Bill Murray had joined the cast, but wasn't actually, he didn't take off. So Gilda and Belushi had something of a rivalry, although I think they also really adored each other. But by the time the Blues Brothers project was falling into place, Lorne was kind of siding with Gilda, and Gilda had a stage show she was going to do. And it became kind of Lorne and Gilda on the one hand versus Belushi and some of those guys on the other.
So the Blues Brothers are born maybe on Saturday Night Live. Then there's the album, and it's a big enough hit. They said, well, let's give these guys a movie. So talk to me a little bit about the making of the movie.
Well, the first thing you got to know is they weren't making movies in Chicago. I mean, I think you and I both remember this. I mean, I couldn't think of hardly any. I think Cooley School, My Bodyguard, there wasn't much. And anyway, so Jane Byrne had become mayor. And the legend of Mayor Daley the Elder, the guy who could never utter a grammatically correct sentence, loomed large. But his cronies, Daley's cronies, I think gave Mayor Byrne a hard time. She was the first female mayor. I think they were sexist, frankly, toward her, misogynist. And so she suddenly was presented with this opportunity on the one hand, to reopen the city to filming, and then on the other, because Daley was the one who put a halt to it back in the 50s, and then on the other, to have a military convoy roll over Richard J. Daley Plaza, and I think she was kind of pleased at that idea.
There were some scenes they had to sell her and the city on, right?
Well, rolling the said convoy across Daley Plaza was one of them. They shut down the city. I mean, I can't imagine Chicago putting up with this now. You know, like Lakeshore Drive would be like closed, and like Lake Street would be closed, and Lower Wacker would be closed, and they'd be monitoring dozens and dozens of intersections and stopping you from rolling onto the, you know, because you'd collide with a real staged car crash. And I just can't, Chicago just went along with it. I mean, everybody's like, okay, you know, I guess Chicago had a small town feel to it, didn't it? Everybody in town knew it was happening. That's my recollection. And so they went along with it.
Was it the Blues Brothers, or I guess it was Animal House, that the network executives just thought this, nobody wanted to make that movie. But I guess after Animal House, then the Blues Brothers was anything these guys want to do. Was that the attitude?
You're exactly right. Animal House was a huge hit for John Landis, for Universal, and for Belushi. It made him a massive star. He was on the cover of Newsweek. There was this whole, you know, toga party nonsense going on. And there was going to be another Belushi movie. That was without question. The only question was what the movie was going to be. And you'd be surprised how little the studios really cared what the actual movie was. They just needed a Belushi film. And in that particular year, 1978, Belushi and Aykroyd were all in on the Blues Brothers. That was all they were interested in. They were telling interviewers, if you'd interviewed them that year, they would have insisted that you call them Jake and Elwood. They wouldn't have let you call them Belushi and Aykroyd. They were totally into these characters. So then it became clear, okay, Blue wants to do the Blues Brothers, so that's what we're going to do.
I must tell you, I appreciated how you wrote about John Belushi's last moments. I thought your prose was pretty spare. You just let the story tell itself. And it might have been tempting for other writers to expand on that, but the facts and the scene are stark and gripping enough that just telling us what happened is chilling and just awful. Just comment for a minute, if you would, on Belushi's last day.
All I can say is I didn't know when I was going to end this book. And when I wrote, you know, the death scene where Belushi dies, he's at the Chateau Marmont. You know, he wakes up. He's terribly, terribly sick. He takes a huge overdose of the speedball thing. And basically, I think it just stopped his heart. After I'd written that scene and then the beautiful funeral and the beautiful memorial, mm-hmm. I didn't want to write anymore because my book was about this friendship, right? And the friendship ended, I mean, that day. So I just, it's funny, I just put down my keyboard and stopped. I did not know that that was going to be the end until I'd written it.
The story is that they tell Aykroyd, and they tell Aykroyd to tell Judy, John's wife.
Judy,
right?
Yeah.
Because Aykroyd had to tell her, and they had to get to her before she found out about it.
Right. It's interesting. News traveled more slowly back then.
Yeah.
You could imagine how quickly it would spread now. But Aykroyd had to, like, sprint to their apartment and race up the stairs and tell Judy. And yeah, I mean, thank you for, I tried to write that respectfully, but it's a terribly sad moment. And yeah, luckily he did get there in time. He was able to break the news to the widow Belushi.
Daniel DeVissey's book is The Blues Brothers, An Epic Friendship, The Rise of Improv, and The Making of an American Film Classic. Every Chicagoan will love this, and everybody will love this. It's just such a well-told story. I'm really glad you took the time to write it and took the time to tell us about it, Daniel. Thank you.
You know, I love Chicago. I love you guys. I miss the city.
Next time you're in town, we'd love to see you in the studio.
Love that.
That's Daniel DeVissey, The Blues Brothers.